We've been on the air about 3 years now, and we're to the point now where our listeners are emailing us and calling us from all over the world, frequently with suggestions for shows and ideas for things that we should examine. And recently, I got such an email from a woman named Eileen Jarrett. I'd never met Eileen before, and she had a show idea. And the show idea involved Iceland. Yeah, me too. Iceland, I said, why exactly would I do a show about Iceland? And she said, because they've just gone through a grassroots constitutional convention. She didn't have to say anything anymore. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and our topic today is blueberry soup.
Your weekly constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
Blueberry soup is a comfort food from Iceland, of all places. It's also the title of a new documentary by a woman named Eileen Jarrett. And it's all about a recent constitutional, a grassroots constitutional process in the island nation of Iceland. A little bit of background. You remember the financial crisis? Yeah. It still seems to be going on to some extent. But back in 2007, 2008, 2009, bad things were happening, not just here in the United States, but all over the world. And one of the hardest hit countries on a per capita basis was the tiny nation of Iceland. It was so bad there that people started questioning the fundamental premises upon which they governed themselves, and they started asking questions. You know, where did our Constitution come from? Why does it allow things like this to happen? Can we do better? And in a process that used social media, that used modern communications, that was extremely egalitarian, a large number of people from Iceland got together, talked about these issues, and came up with a number of interesting constitutional proposals that at the end of the road were, oh no, I'm not going to give away the end of it, but I will talk to Eileen Jarrett, and she'll tell us the whole story.
I guess the impetus of this would be in 2008, the financial crisis that happened in Iceland, three of their major banks collapsed and caused absolute catastrophe. And so how that resulted in the Constitution was they decided, let's have a forum. Let's randomly select 1,000 Icelanders to come into one of the public centers and talk about, what do you need to see your government do to regain confidence in your nation? What needs to happen henceforth to make sure that this never happens again, and that you feel security, and that you feel that you can raise your children here? What future can you imagine Iceland having after such, you know, a crisis?
So, and it was a catastrophe, wasn't it? I mean, the whole country basically just collapsed. I mean, there were a number of countries, I'm thinking of Ireland or Greece or Italy, Spain, that suffered more than the average bear, but Iceland, basically the whole country was bankrupt there, and all the major banks failed.
For the size of Iceland, it was the largest we've had in history.
Yeah,
so it
was
enormous.
It was, and when it was like all the major banks in the United States failing, I mean, that takes us back to the early 1930s when banks were failing and people were panicked and there were runs on the banks and people couldn't get their savings out. And, I mean, the whole financial system was coming to a halt, but that actually happened in Iceland, didn't it?
That absolutely did. And I'm not sure if you've already heard about this, but during that time, there was so much anger in the air, and people actually took to the streets, and they stood outside of Parliament with pots and pans, and they now refer to this as the kitchenware revolution, and they demanded the people in charge to step down and say, you are responsible, get out of here. And it worked. It actually worked.
And so a bunch of people actually did resign.
That's right. Yeah,
wow.
And they got some really fabulous people in there. And along with that, I believe a lot of inspired citizens that said, okay, so what can we do now? And with that 1,000 people that they had brought forward to talk about, you know, what can we do?
Wait a second, Eileen. I want to get very clear on this. Now, this was sort of an organic thing that just happened on social media. Is that how it all came about?
I would say so. Iceland has a lot of really great think tanks. They have a lot of really strong entrepreneurs. So a lot of those people put their day jobs aside and stood up to try to be part of the bigger picture. So there were leaders in this. There were people that were trying to wake the society up a little bit to their options. You know, you have the EU kind of looming over. You have IMF loans looming over, just waiting for catastrophes like this to happen. And so they wanted to approach this differently. They wanted to retain their independence. They wanted to look at this as a time to rebuild rather than a time of, oh my gosh, this is the worst ever. What can we possibly do? We're absolutely stranded.
This is sounding like a peaceful Tahrir Square. I mean, instead of going out with tear gas and guns and whatever else, these people were going out with pots and pans. And then out of this peaceful protest, led by a few entrepreneurs, think tank people, a few others, then this grassroots initiative began. Is that how it happened?
That's right. That's exactly right. And you know, one
this
point
is sounding like pure democracy here to me.
This is exactly right. This is democracy current day. And that's where Facebook and Twitter and social media came into play with the rewriting of the Constitution, which was the aftermath of this upheaval. So what they did with the Constitution is they said, one rule, we cannot have bankers or politicians in this constitutional assembly. We don't trust them. We got to have our own people in here.
No bankers or politicians, Eileen, but what about lawyers? Did they let lawyers in?
Tons of lawyers.
Oh, okay, good. Well, I'm glad. I'm glad of that. Okay, go on.
And part of that was they knew that if they didn't have the lawyers to review the legalese, to review the type of vocabulary, that it would never pass. It could possibly be interpreted later on down the road in something horrible. So they said,
I'm going to put in a little plug for my profession here. You know, lawyers are often maligned, and sometimes with good reason. I mean, lawyers are people too, and there are always going to be some unethical few and a few who do things that embarrass the rest of us. But when you look at our own constitutional history, it was lawyers who wrote the Constitution. It was lawyers who agitated. It was lawyers who largely led much of the revolution here in this country. And I'm pleased to see that lawyers were involved in this grassroots movement as well.
I absolutely agree. Two of the main characters in Blueberry Soup were actually lawyers, female lawyers that were on the Constitutional Assembly. And one of them, her opening statement was, hi, you know, this is my name, this is where I'm from, and my first court case was against the police, and I won. Very good. So that's
okay.
Just
you've mentioned the title of this documentary that you've done twice, and I cannot let it go again without asking, what in the world does blueberry soup reference?
So blueberry soup is an Icelandic comfort food, and I chose that to emphasize the community aspects that brought this constitution to fruition. It wasn't just a group of politicians. It was the people, and it was a lot of people that were both very inspired and very angry, and that could see the forest through the trees, I guess you could say.
So if you were doing something like that in the United States, you could name it like cornbread and grits.
Absolutely. I think you're onto something.
Okay, something like that. Okay, if something similar happened here. Okay, so this is the grassroots aspect of it. This is the fact that people are taking comfort in one another. Now, but we also have to talk about now, when did you get involved? You sound like you're an American. You're not Icelandic, are you?
That's right. I'm not Icelandic.
Okay, so what in the world brought this to your attention? I mean, I heard about Iceland too, but the last thing that would have occurred to me was to go there and do a documentary on this. So how did you get involved?
I got involved back right when the crisis happened. I was completely enchanted by the art coming out of Iceland, and I thought, wouldn't it be great to just go there and document what's happening and with the art specifically? And I got there, and I was introduced to some of these startups. And what I was most afraid of, I suppose, is how little this was being talked about in the global media and even in the Icelandic media. And I started thinking, oh gosh, this is a time that I'm going to have to report this. Like, all of a sudden, it's this drop of anxiety as a documentarian when you realize, oh no, I can't ignore this.
Wait a second. So you were going there to document Icelandic art.
That's right.
Okay,
That's
and you
right.
get there and you think to yourself, okay, no more art. Now it's time for politics.
Now there's something happening. You can kind of feel the ground rumble, and there are people that are trying really hard to make a difference and to see things differently and restructure. And I thought, wow, this is a very universal concept right now. And one of the most interesting points is the whole time I've been doing this for 5 years, this particular film, the whole time there were people in Iceland that were naysayers the whole way through. And so when I now screen the film to people in the United States, that's one of the first comments that I'll get is, yeah, but that could never happen here. But in truth, the whole way through, Icelanders also believe, no, this could never happen here. And all of a sudden, it's happening.
Remarkable. But before we get to the end of this story, and let's do this chronologically now. So you show up in Iceland. There you are in Reykjavik. And before we leave this art thing, I have to ask you, were you looking for art that was being produced as part of this movement, or were you simply more generically interested in Icelandic art?
That's right. No, you're right on with that. I was looking for the contrast. Before, I was really interested in Icelandic art that was very ethereal, very gentle, kind of another world. And I thought, what kind of art will be produced in lieu of the crisis, in this shift? And so that kind of was the doorway into this other world that was
happening.
Okay,
so one day you just get up and you go to Reykjavik, or you go to Iceland. I mean, have you ever been there before?
I had never been there before. And we went with just enough
I'm sorry, I'm still trying to get my mind around this. You just picked up and went to Iceland.
Oh, I wish I could tell you it was that easy. We had lots of brownie fundraisers and borrowing money from family members and, you know, asking favors of friends to borrow equipment. I had never done anything on this scale, and I just had this very odd sense that I had to keep going. I had to figure out what was going on and be there to document it. And there was only three of us that went the first time, and oddly enough, that worked in our favor. That allowed a very comfortable situation for people to speak candidly and to say, oh, you want to speak to the prime minister? That's my cousin. Let me call her right now.
This gets better. This gets better and better, Eileen. Okay, so now I know where blueberry soup comes from, and now I know who you are. So when you got there and you realized you wanted to cover the politics, what did you find? How did it unfold?
What I found were a lot of the same obstacles that we experience in the United States. Tons of bureaucracy, tons of just obstacles as far as finances and timeline. And what happened with this constitution in particular is 525 people ran for 25 seats on the council. So that just shows you how many people saw that this was an opportunity to change the system that was already in effect, and to just kind of rewrite the nation's document to make sure that, you know, not just that the economic collapse wouldn't happen again, but other problems that were happening in society, things that affected everyone very deeply. And oh, it was just phenomenal. So
where did they meet? Did they rent a hall or in the government buildings or where?
For the beginning, for the people that were running for the 25 seats, this was all over Iceland. So they would rent out little halls and people could state their platforms. And if you couldn't make it to a hall, you could broadcast through YouTube your platform. So it was so funny. You'd see this person in like a sweatshirt sitting in their desk chair at home talking about what they would do if they had the opportunity to be on the council.
Good heavens. And you also said something about picking 1,000 people randomly. Well, where does that come in? How did that all fit together?
So that was right before the 525 decided to run. So the 1,000 came together and they said, all right, part of this reimagining Iceland is we have to relook at our constitution. It wasn't written by us. This was a Danish constitutional spinoff. It's a document that's dated. We should have rewritten it a long time ago. There's been lots of attempts. Now's the time.
Okay, so the 1,000 said we need to rewrite it. Then they said, okay, let's have a council and let's put it, you know, let's make it a manageable number of 25. And then 525 decided to run for it, and they were doing it sometimes over YouTube.
That's right.
And who all got to vote in deciding who those 25 representatives would be?
It was a national referendum, so the people voted directly.
And was this run by the government, or was it done over social media? How was the election administered?
It was both. I don't know if you had also heard about the results of this. So after the election, after the 25 had been chosen, quite quickly after, two of the people that had ran and lost, and then one other, decided to sue the election process, stating that it was unconstitutional and that the way that it was held was not private enough, along with a laundry list of other reasons they felt that it wasn't a legal election. So when you do that to a society that's already feeling extremely vulnerable and depleted, you know, that's just like kicking somebody when they're already down. So this was so hard to get going back up. The prime minister stood up and said, nope, this is important. The people voted for it. I'm pushing it through, except I'm going to change the name from Constitutional Assembly to Constitutional Council. So she elected all the same people that were elected in the referendum to be on this council.
Okay, so this, so the government was getting involved, sort of.
That's right.
Stepping into the breach anyway to assist this process and moving forward.
That's right. The government was involved in setting the guidelines as well with the people.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. I'm speaking with filmmaker Eileen Jarrett all about her new documentary, Blueberry Soup. It's the story of the constitutional process prompted by the financial crisis in, of all places, Iceland. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more with Eileen Jarrett. Stay tuned. Well, once again, into the studio, like a giant, strides the quiz guy. Or is it the Riddler? The Riddler today, all decked out in his green suit and his green mask with his question marks everywhere. Well, Riddler Doug Smith, you have a riddle for us today.
I do. I've got a great riddle today. Okay. So the riddle today, the answer is going to be a person. Okay. So let's get into it. I'm an English bard known for tragedy. My Stratford-upon-Avon house has welcomed U.S. presidents. Two future presidents arrive together, and they seem to like my chair, maybe since they wouldn't have their own at the U.S. Constitutional Convention. Who am I?
Wait a minute, that last line there. So you're saying two future presidents who were not at the Constitutional Convention.
That's right. Two future presidents not at the convention showed up to my house, and they must have really liked one of my chairs.
They must have. So the question is, who are you?
Who am I? I'm an English bard.
An English bard. All right. Well, do we have a contestant on the line?
Yes.
What's your name?
Philip Levin.
From where?
From Chilhowie.
From Chilhowie, Virginia. Chilhowie, Virginia. I've always loved that name.
Is it Chilhowie or Chilhowie?
We're chilling in Chilhowie.
Chilhowie.
Or Chilhowie. Tremendous. Well, do you have an answer for our riddler?
You know, that is a tough one. A president not at the Constitutional Convention.
Well, the guys who went to the House were not at the Constitutional Convention, but the description of the fellow you're looking for is an English bard. And what's his hometown, Doug?
Stratford-upon-Avon.
So this is really more of an English quiz than it is a constitutional quiz.
You know, I'm going to go with Thomas Jefferson, but I feel like that's not correct.
I'm going to help you here because we're not looking for the guys who visited the house. We're looking for the owner of the house.
But it was true that Thomas Jefferson is one of the future presidents that attended the house.
In fact, I'm going to fill in something here. I bet the other future president was John Adams, wasn't it?
It was. How did you know that?
I just kind of guessed.
It's because neither one of them were at the convention.
They were neither at the convention, and I also know they spent some time in England together just chilling, as they do in Chilhowie. And they went all over London, they went all over England, and they went to Stratford-upon-Avon, and that's as much time as I'm going to give you. Who was the English bard from Stratford-upon-Avon, Philip?
Benjamin Franklin.
Benjamin Franklin.
I don't think it was Benjamin Franklin. I'm sorry, Philip.
In fact, the English bard is William Shakespeare.
Really?
William Shakespeare. His house is in Stratford-upon-Avon, and oddly enough, in 1786... So before the Constitutional Convention, when Adams and Jefferson were kind of traveling around the country, Adams and Jefferson pop into his house, and they must have liked a chair because rumor has it they chipped off a piece of chair as a souvenir.
No way.
Yeah, there you go.
They were vandals?
Yeah.
Adams and Jefferson go to Shakespeare's house and they chip off a piece of a
No way.
It's like a bad a bad joke, isn't it?
It really is. Oh my gosh, I've heard about American tourists being a bit loutish overseas, but that takes the cake.
Well, I'm sure him being English didn't help. You know, at the time we were still limping after the revolution. You know, if it had been France, of course Jefferson would never have chipped anything off of that furniture. But he would have been happy to have sat upon it.
This was a continuing act of rebellion, is what you're saying.
It is. You know, America at the time was, we were really just embracing France tremendously, particularly all the help that they had given us during the Revolution. But, you know, William Shakespeare, he's very much a known element. And Jefferson and Adams, they make their way past his house, pop in, and rumor has it, take a little piece of the chair with them on the way out.
Well, I'm sorry, Philip, that you didn't get a T-shirt.
Well, that's quite all right. I enjoyed playing.
Well, we appreciate it, and you do get a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier, so thanks very much.
Great, thank you.
All right, Stuart, there you go. There's your riddle for the week. Hey, it's the Constitution. We read it for the article.
Just over 4 years ago, the tiny island republic of Iceland experienced the worst economic collapse of any European country. Growth sank, house prices plunged, unemployment soared, and all the banks had to be nationalized. But unlike here, Iceland let its troubled banks simply die, and since 2011, the country has seen growth averaging at over 2%, comfortably more than here in the UK. The macroeconomic good news, however, masks the pain being felt by many ordinary Icelanders. Jo Lynham has been there to ask what we can learn from the Icelandic experience.
President Grimson has been in office for 16 years and has seen boom and bust.
We have a very strong sense of history and of our culture. But mingled with that sense of solidarity and deep roots and history is also an entrepreneurial sense that perhaps led us astray in the years before the crash, but has also enabled a nation of farmers and fishermen to transform itself from being, up to the 1960s or the 1970s, among the poorest countries in Europe, to having achieved now one of the highest standards of living that you can find in the world, despite the difficulties that follow the crash. Fundamentally, we are still a nation of farmers and fishermen.
Yeah. So what is the political situation like in Iceland that even makes a rewrite of a constitution possible?
Well, so after the crash, there's been this kind of post-crash survivalism. A lot of protests originally back in 2008, 2009, which led to the formation of new political movements. And there's it's basically led to a lot of people who were formerly entirely passive in politics have become empowered to participate. And there's a strong interest in doing something new. But at the same time, we've seen a lot of crash denialism, in a sense, from the right wing. A lot of people seem to have forgotten the Independence Party's role in creating the conditions for the crash. And there's been this interesting spin campaign, which is actually fascinating to watch it unravel, from the right wing, saying that every part of the constitutional process is entirely unreliable and so on. Despite lots of evidence to the contrary. So it's still a bit unstable, and we don't really know what we'll see next.
The people of Iceland kept saying more and more and louder, we're not going to be forced to pay for the bank's mistakes and greed and stupidity. And it finally, the only way they resolved it is they went into their legislative government buildings with crowbars and literally pried the bastards out.
In Iceland, four former bank chiefs have been jailed for fraud. The sentences go as far as 5 years behind bars. They're accused of concealing that a Qatari investor bought a stake in their firm, using cash lent from the bank itself, illegally. The deal took place just ahead of the collapse of the bank due to huge debts. For more insight, let's cross live to economic expert Charlie McGrath, founder of news website Wide Awake News. Thank you for joining us, sir. Now, this is the biggest penalty for such crimes in Iceland's history. Explain why this is so significant.
Well, it's significant in regards to the 2008 crisis, because if you happen to be living here in the United States, you know, where a lot of these, the majority of these too-big-to-fail institutions are headquartered, where the true culprits are, where they're living, these CEOs and COOs of these massive corporations, these massive too-big-to-fail institutions, not one of them has went to jail. Not one of them has been indicted. There's been a handful of token fines that have been paid by these corporations, and let me reiterate, by the corporations, not by these individuals themselves. So we see an actual government, an actual people, a nation stepping up and saying, I'm sorry, you committed fraud, you screwed over a nation, and you're going to pay for it with your butt being put behind bars. This is exactly what needed to happen in the United States and the rest of the world. It's what needs to happen now. And my hat's off to Iceland for standing up to these bankers.
Here in the United States, none of our banksters have ever been held to account. In fact, they're giving themselves billion-dollar bonuses. What did you all in Iceland do with your banksters?
Shortly after the crash, there was a special prosecutor's office set up, which was intended to investigate the crash. And so far, it's prosecuted a couple of banksters, a couple of bankers who were involved in various deals. There have been a couple of cases of civil servants who have actually been investigated, and one is currently doing jail time for that. There's a couple of bankers who've been remitted to custody. So we're cleaning things up, but it is a very long process because, sure, you know, there is a very strong need to protect the rule of law.
It's probably time we do a little housekeeping with our own Constitution here in the United States, or at least just reread it to show that nowhere in it are corporations given the same rights as people.
The reason I thought this was important is because we have such a problem with money and politics here. And these people, they actually said no to the banks. They said no to the bailouts. They fired and put people in jail who did everything wrong. It is completely the reverse of everything we've done in this country. We bailed these people out. Nobody got fired. And they got rid of the debt that they did not incur. I think this is a great story, and it's completely underreported. Is there any chance we can look at something like this and go, we could do a little better here
in America? I wish. Maybe in Sherman Oaks, California. Well, do you see what I'm saying? Because we have way too many people. And with the amount of people that we have and the history that we have as a country,
yeah.
They have 300,000 people. More people watch the Super Bowl than they have in their entire country.
Yeah, more people watch an average football game,
not even the Super Bowl. Exactly. Yeah. So, of course, they can kind of come to some sort of agreement. And all the people, and I hate to say this, but the backgrounds of the people are pretty much the same, you know, this Norse background, right? In this country, we have, it's a melting pot.
I'll tell you, I don't necessarily think it's the melting pot issue that would cause a problem here. The reason this thing won't happen here is because of the way we elect our officials and how we allow big money to get into the process. That's going to be the real issue, because I think once you get into this country and you see how things work, I don't even know that it's a difference in background that changes the way that you think about it. I think people start seeing what might be better. We just can't get officials in who will actually do it because our election process is so messed up.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with documentary filmmaker Eileen Jarrett all about her film Blueberry Soup. Now, that's a strange title. It refers both to the Icelandic comfort food and also to her new film all about the recent constitutional process in the small island nation of Iceland.
So you get 25 people. Eventually, they're seated as the Constitutional Council. And what do they do?
So the guideline is that after they write the draft, they will have to present this as a national referendum also to the people. If the people vote yes, this will then go to parliament. If the parliament votes yes, then this will be the official Icelandic constitution, but it will have to go through both stages of approval. So they begin. They have 3 months to do this. They've already extended that into, I believe, 4 months. And these people just work. And this Constitutional Council was made up of farmers, lawyers, doctors, students, activists, radio hosts, mathematicians, museum gallery operators, just people that represent such a wide variety of the society, kind of coming together. So in that, I found that very beautiful. And when I came to the first meeting, I was sitting there and thinking, wow, this is pretty awful that everybody's on their computer looking at Facebook. You know, isn't it more important than that? And then I was told, no, what they're doing is they're broadcasting live the issues on Facebook so that the entire nation can participate on the spot. So they would actually bring up, hey, Jonas from the West Fjords is suggesting that we add this into the rights of children. And then they would talk about it, and wouldn't you know, it would end up somehow in the document. They also had a live draft where people could go on and see the vocabulary board and amend it there and say, well, referencing the South African Constitution, we should take into consideration this and this could happen.
That's absolutely remarkable, and in fact, I think this is probably thus far the strongest contrast I've seen with our own constitutional history, because, as I'm sure you know, our own Constitutional Convention of 1787 was completely closed. I mean, there was this rule of secrecy. Nobody could talk about what happened on the convention floor, and in fact, I've spoken with at least one constitutional scholar who thought that was an essential part of the constitutional drafting process. He thinks the entire thing would have been derailed if it had been done openly, but you're having exactly the opposite experience in Iceland.
That's right. And it's just a theory that was because of the banking collapse happening out of so many closed rooms. And so I think there was a fear that if transparency didn't exist, then the same things could happen again.
So clearly then, throughout 2008, and I'm guessing into 2009, you've got this very open process that eventually resulted in a draft, right?
That's right.
And then what did they do with the draft?
So the draft was brought to a national referendum, and it passed, which was just such an enormous success. And then when it was brought to Parliament, it was turned down.
Oh, no. So you got, like, through two of the three stages.
That's right.
And yet at the very last stage, and it sounds like the professional politicians were the ones who turned it down.
And one of the things that they said often in the Constitution was, we're trying so hard to make a draft that the people are so involved in, that are so married to, that the government can't possibly turn it down because their people voted for it. So somehow this still got turned down, which, yeah.
Well, what sort of vote was it? I mean, well, first of all, what was the plebiscite? I mean, what sort of margin did you have when the people actually had the referendum?
You know, I'm so sorry to say, I actually don't know those numbers.
Okay, but apparently that was not enough to make the professional politicians in the parliament feel like they had to go along with their own people. Was there any sort of backlash against the parliamentarians when they rejected this referendum?
Now, the government that exists in the parliament is very similar to what was there when the crisis happened. So there's been a shift, and I don't know if it's directly correlated with turning the constitution down, but that's another shocking point, is that some of the same people that were involved in the economic collapse are back in power.
Well, Eileen, I don't want to sound overly negative, but it sounds then like ultimately the movement failed.
You know what? I think that's really interesting to think about. And I've put a lot of thought into this too, but the way that I've seen people react from seeing this process maybe could be more important when we focus on the themes, when we focus on the ideas that came up, that they were able to draft something to bring it to the stage that they did. And maybe by a parliament turning it down, it was just kind of indicative of how much we do need this. That the structure that exists still isn't representing the people completely.
Right.
I mean, I'm kind of just the relay runner, and I'm passing the baton on. I saw something really incredible, and it moved me to dedicate my life to the last 5 years of making this and communicating these ideas. So I've already seen some really beautiful ideas come out of the inspiration from that. And I can't wait to see what goes even further than that.
Well, let's talk about that. So the process comes to its sad conclusion.
Yes.
You have captured this all on film. Could you tell me a little bit more about that process? You were going to tell me that the people were offering to introduce you to their friend, the prime minister. Tell me a little bit about that process of making the film, and then maybe we'll talk about the film itself then.
Sure. So making the film, we did this on a very, very small budget, many dinnerless kind of nights. I went there alone a majority of the time, and just had a very small camera that I was able to sit down and have very intimate discussions. I tried to steer away from, in the end, interviewing politicians because of how they decided to construct the Constitution. By them deciding we don't want politicians and bankers to be the voice of this document, I thought, well, then it makes sense to have a film where that's the same. So I interviewed as many people as I could speak to about this, and really entertaining, eclectic group in the end of just kind of voicing this story.
And that is that basically then what the film has turned out to be, is a series of interviews?
The film in the end is the connection between the social circles of the people that were elected to the Constitutional Council. So we follow four women back and forth to their private social groups and what they discuss there and how that affects the decisions being made in the council.
I see. Now, what? And you've obviously completed production of your film now. What have you done with it now that you have a finished product?
We began our screening at Harvard University as a guest of Lawrence Lessig, and we were able to screen the film to the law school there and then the next day go into his Article 5 class and speak to that class about the ideas that they took from the film. So what the next stage is we're taking the film on a U.S. tour and also a little bit into Canada, and we're presenting it to law schools and as far as human rights and ethics, and trying to see what ideas come from these main themes.
So you're starting a conversation. I think you need to
starting a conversation. Yeah.
You need to speak with Chris Phillips. Do you know Chris,
the author? No, I don't.
He's written a couple of books. He's very much into participatory democracy. He's written Jefferson's Cafe and another book called Constitution Cafe. And he is, next to you, he is the most participatory, open, transparent government type of guy I've ever met. Mm-hmm. And it's a match made in heaven. I think the two of you need to get together, and I'll be very happy to be the conduit for that. But did you also mention that they had a class specifically on Article 5 at Harvard Law School?
Isn't that great? Yes.
That's remarkable. And Article 5 is the part of our Constitution that is about amending it, is about changing mm-hmm. it, and about calling, as one option, calling a constitutional convention. And that segues very nicely into my next question. Is that what you personally would like to see happen, is a similar process happen here with a new American Constitutional Convention?
You know, I would love to see this in the hands of someone that could take those ideas and run with it. I don't know personally what would be best for us. For an example, right after the Harvard screen, I met two wonderful people from New Orleans. One is a lawyer, and the other one is heavily involved in arts and documentation. And both of them together decided, we're going to take these ideas and run with it in New Orleans. After Katrina, there's been a lot of talk about rebuilding and what does society look like after that catastrophe. And so what they're starting right now is amending the New Orleans type constitution and finding a way of using that participatory democracy, using social media to involve the entire society that wants to be involved and hear their ideas and implement that into a new structure. So to me, that is exactly why I made this film. You know, that is the conclusion that I had in my dreams, is that somebody would see this and immediately click it into an idea that they could put into fruition. They could take their own skill set, their own area of interest, and say, I feel stronger and I feel inspired. And here we go.
Well, I'll play devil's advocate for just a minute, Eileen.
Sure.
I recall 30 years ago in college being shocked when a political science professor pointed out to me that in more than one survey, when Americans were presented with the Bill of Rights, they thought that, in the words of the era, they were sort of communistic, that they were not something that they would necessarily vote for if they were given the opportunity. And I've heard many people say over the years, it's a good thing that we have our Bill of Rights, because if we put them to a plebiscite, they might not pass a second time. So in other words, there's a great deal of fear, at least among people like me, who make a living off of this, who spend their time thinking about constitutional issues, that a constitutional convention would be a very frightening thing, and that we might end up really derailing a lot of good stuff if we sure. if we had such a powerful body made up of perhaps randomly selected people. Do those fears resonate with you, or do you think they're unfounded?
Absolutely. And maybe the ideal is not to have a constitutional reform. Maybe that isn't it, but maybe feeling empowered and feeling like you could take some kind of influence from the example that Iceland set, that even if you don't have a lot of money, even if you don't have a lot of support, your ideas are still extremely valid, and that great change is absolutely possible, and can be for the better. So even if it's not constitutional change in our country, maybe it's just change in different structures that aren't working for us specifically.
Okay, so this is a broader proposition, and you're not specifically looking for an Article 5 convention. Okay.
That's right.
Well, very interesting, Eileen. Well, this is a fascinating process, and of course, you and I are going to talk about the possibility of doing a screening somewhere way up here in the mountains at some point.
Yes.
Before we leave, before we start talking about such mechanical details, are there any final thoughts before we wrap this up?
I also want to let you know that if anybody isn't going to be in a city where we're screening the film, we have it available online through blueberrysoupfilm.com. And I would love to hear what people take from this. If it's affected you, if it came up in conversation over beers later that night, if you think about it when you're daydreaming, in any way did this resonate with you? That's what I would love to know. I'd love to keep this conversation going.
Blueberry Soup Film, all one word, .com.
That's right.
And people can watch the film there. Well, Eileen Jarrett of Wilma's Wish Productions, what a remarkable tale. And I'm really looking forward to looking at this film. So thanks very much for your time.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we've just finished an absolutely fascinating discussion, if I do say so myself, with Eileen Jarrett, a documentary filmmaker whose new film, Blueberry Soup, is all about the recent grassroots constitutional process in Iceland that was prompted by the financial crisis of the late 2000s. After the break, we'll change locales. We're going to leave Iceland and go back to Montpelier, so stay tuned. Now let's change pace a little bit, change our focus a little bit, and let's talk with one of our friends over at Montpelier. His name is Grant Quatermass, and Grant works in the part of the acquisitions department, I guess we would call it, with Meg Kennedy, and they get stuff from Montpelier, and he's going to tell us about some of their more interesting recent acquisitions.
I'm Grant Quatermass, and I'm one of the assistant curators here at Montpelier.
Tremendous. You've been on the show before, Grant. So, and we talked all about some very interesting paintings. And this time we're going to talk about something else. What's going on?
We're going to talk about Madison's library, which I think is a really interesting subject because of Madison's many roles. People are always interested in what he was reading.
It's a huge issue because, of course, Madison, as everybody who listens to this show knows, came up with a Virginia plan after months and months of study.
And doing research.
And his doing books. Research. So what did he... Absolutely. So this is a fascinating subject. So what do you know about it?
And, you know, it's amazing, first of all, that Madison had about 4,000 volumes in his library.
Good heaven.
And if you think about it, and you know, this is in the 18th and 19th century where acquiring a book was, you know, for many people, especially, you know, a feat in itself. Well, now Madison, you know, spent time in Philadelphia, Washington, these urban places where he had a lot of access to books. But when he was here at Montpelier, he's writing to, you know, people in Fredericksburg to get books. You know, it's not 2013 where you can just get on Amazon and find a book. It was, you know, quite an effort. And it's amazing, too, just some of the different sources that Madison used to get his books. He was in Williamsburg when they had the sale of Governor Dunmore's library. Of course, Governor Dunmore, known as the last colonial governor who flees Virginia in 1775. Well,
they took his library and sold it.
They sold all of the contents of, you know, the governor's palace after he left. And, and so Madison happens to be there, takes advantage of that, and buys books there. Another source, William Byrd's library, arguably one of the largest library, actually probably the largest library in 18th century Virginia. William Byrd II, his son, William Byrd III, died in the 1770s, and his widow sold the library. She advertises it in the Virginia Gazette, and a gentleman by the name of Isaac Zane buys it in block, takes it up to Philadelphia, and sells it there. So Madison, when he's in Philadelphia in the 1780s, is, you know, buying these books formerly from William Byrd's library. So they're actually, you know, you see these extant books that have, you know, William Byrd's nameplate in them and Madison's, you know, name in them too.
Grant, this is so cool because book lovers everywhere will recognize these habits. I mean, books are expensive. And so where do you go? You go to a used bookshop, you pick up some stuff, or if you see a garage sale, you say, hey, I'm going to get me some books.
And you have your friends get books for you,
and
too.
And you have your friends get books for you as well. Course. So Madison was doing...
So Madison is relying on Jefferson and, you know, all of these other friends to acquire books for him. And even in his presidency, and especially in his retirement, he's having authors are sending him copies of books. He's getting, you know, unsolicited copies of, you know, pamphlets of speeches and political things. And so it's very interesting to see, and the variety of stuff that he's reading too. Very much, you know, everything from history, philosophy, religion, agriculture. So, I mean, his interests and what he's reading are, you know, they're greatly varied.
Right.
And that's what a lot of the visitor accounts of the Montpelier Library, again, suggest books on a number of subjects and a number of titles. And so, you know, again, Madison, a very well-read person, and even in his retirement is keeping up with public events. He's subscribing to the National Intelligencer, which was sort of the Washington Post of its day. It was really the newspaper to cover Congress and a lot of the political information. So it was a great way to get the information about what was going on in Washington with current political events.
I've actually heard his library described, at least the old library before he built the new one, as being so crammed full of books that there was almost no place to sit. Every surface covered with books.
Oh, I think that's very much the case. Because if you think about 4,000 books and the linear feet of shelf space you're going to need. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think, you know, he even continued to use that space even once you get the downstairs library constructed, probably as a stacks, if you think about it, for
right.
the storage. Because in addition to books, he had pamphlets and all these periodicals that he subscribed to. So, yes, I think, and it would have been, as you said, books, you know, shelves everywhere stacked.
I kind of wonder if the current iteration of the library, the restored library, is misleadingly neat and spare. I mean, I wonder if to make it more realistic, you just need to start getting books and piling them places.
I don't think, because I think that's likely a space he could have used as a working space. I mean, if you think about having a space for the stacks and storage of your books versus a space for writing and research and that.
I know lots of people with very messy offices, so workspace tends to be stack space. But be that as it may, what's happening lately with the library? I understand you guys have been doing some work on it.
We are. We're working on the project to furnish the upstairs library, and it's given us an opportunity to really to do more of the research on Madison's library. And as I was saying earlier, I think it's just interesting the variety of books he had, and even as he's getting older, too, how the books, not only how he's planning for their dispersal, but their eventual dispersal as well, because people, you know, always ask, well, what happened to Madison's library? And it's not one of these things where, you know, Jefferson sold his en masse to the government to make up the nucleus of the kind of reconstructed Library of Congress after the British burned the earlier Library of Congress. But, you know, Madison's books, it's a slightly different story. And even, you know, as he's getting older, he's kind of planning for the dispersal of his library as he writes his will, or actually even before that, because in 1834, a gentleman writes to him from the Naval Lyceum, which was it was based at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and says, you know, we're putting together a library for our Lyceum. We would like to, you know, have each of the living presidents and other historical figures send a book. Instead of sending a single book, Madison sends them an entire box of books.
Wow.
So he's kind of, you know, looking at dispersal of his state. And then in his will, he basically says that he leaves the University of Virginia, the books from his library, with the exception of 300 books that Dolly can choose, mm-hmm. that she wants to retain. So the balance goes to the University of Virginia. And it actually took them about 20 years to get the books that they were left in his will.
Oh, really?
Because
Dolly took that long to pick out which one she wanted?
No, various issues about that. There's actually one document that's a deed where Dolly signs them over to John Payne Todd, so he claimed some of them were his.
Okay. And this ties in with the John Payne Todd difficulty and the fact that he was probably wanting to sell these books, wasn't he?
And he was selling some of them.
Oh, okay.
But, and it's really interesting because one of the things I was looking at in doing this research was all the minutes from the Board of Visitors meetings in the late 1830s, where one of the topics they're discussing is the bequest of Madison's books. Because in addition to the bequest of books, he actually leaves them a financial legacy as mm-hmm. well for the library and gives that. But
did they get that?
Yes.
Oh, okay, they did get the money. Okay, it was just the books.
Fairly soon after, the university and Dolly are writing back and forth, and Dolly even makes mention in a letter to a friend that she's involved with John Payne Todd, with her niece Annie, and two clerks making an inventory of the library. And what's very frustrating for us is that inventory doesn't survive.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one was taken. So that's one of the aspects of this project is we've been kind of reconstructing the titles in Madison's library. Anytime we see a mention in these extant documents of a book that goes into our research database.
So listeners, note, if anybody has something that looks like an inventory of Madison's library, I think that Grant and Meg would be very happy to receive it.
And I will say, too, with Madison's books, Madison typically writes his name in the upper right-hand corner of a title page of a book. Okay. So,
check that first page, the upper right-hand corner. If you have any doubt, go ahead and give Grant a call.
And I will say what's confusing, too, are James Madison's cousin, the Bishop James Madison, of course, president of the College of William and Mary, very much a contemporary of Madison, had his own library. And so, I've seen instances of a book where it was actually probably Bishop Madison's book.
Right, because his name was also James.
His name was also James. So, again, going back to kind of the dispersal of Madison's library, like I said, it takes them about 20 years. It's after John Payne Todd's death in 1852 that they finally are able to get the books they need. They take a little over 400 of the books. The rest are actually sold on the steps of the Orange County Courthouse in 1854. And the proceeds from that sale went to fund these outstanding debts that John Payne Todd had. So UVA finally gets the books that, they'd been promised almost 18 years before in Madison's will, and they put them in the library, which was at the time in the Rotunda.
Right.
So they're in the Rotunda until 1895, when you have the Rotunda fire.
Oh, geez.
So
you could have kind of wished they'd waited another 50 years before getting them. Yeah, that's one of the great ironies in all of this is that I think there were a lot of volumes there, not just of Madison's, but didn't Jefferson contribute a huge number, and then they all burned up in the fire?
Yes.
And that's just what a terrible loss. Do you have any of his actual original volumes
here
at all?
We actually have one.
One?
Of his
just one.
Books. There are very few of his books, like I said, that are extant.
Right.
In addition to the ones...
Well, I have to ask, what is it? What is the one book that you have of James Madison's?
An 18th century Doctrina Antiqua, an 18th century philosophical book.
Did he annotate it?
No, but it does have his name up
he
in the right
He did sign it, at least. Okay. All right.
Page.
Well, then we know we got one, then. Okay. One down, 399 to go. Well, Grant Quatermass of Montpelier.
Actually, more than 399 if he had 4,000.
Oh, excuse me. 3,999 to go. Absolutely. Well, Grant, thanks very much for speaking to us today, and we'll check in with you periodically.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you as always, Stuart.
All right.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for Eileen Jarrett talking to us about her new documentary, Blueberry Soup, all about the grassroots constitutional process in the island nation of Iceland. Thanks also to our buddy, Grant Quatermass of Montpelier, telling us all about Madison's books. Pretty important subject, I'd say. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our theme music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment, and maybe even the Icelandic experiment.